Welcome to the Sevsken Fiscal Quarter Earnings Release Call. Your hosts for today's call are Mike Mauer and Jay Agarwal. Operator assistance is available anytime during this conference by pressing star zero. A question-and-answer session will follow the presentation. I will now hand the call over to your speakers. Gentlemen, you may begin.
Thank you, Operator. This is Mike Mauer, and I'd like to thank everyone for calling in today and joining us. With me today, I've got Chris Jansen, my Co-Chief Investment Officer, and Jay Agarwal, our CFO. Before we begin, Jay will first discuss some general information and comment on the forward-looking statements. Jay?
I'd like to remind everyone that today's call is being recorded. Please note that this call is the property of CM Finance, Inc., and any unauthorized broadcast of this call in any form is strictly prohibited. Audio replay of the call will be available by using the telephone numbers provided in our press release announcing this call. I'd also like to call your attention to the customary safe harbor disclosure in our press release regarding forward-looking information. Today's conference call may also include forward-looking statements and projections, and we ask that you refer to our most recent filing with the SEC for important factors that could cause actual results to differ materially from these projections. We will not update our forward-looking statements unless required by law. To obtain copies of our latest SEC filings, please visit our website at www.cmfn-inc.com. At this time, I'd like to turn the call back to our Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Michael Mauer.
Thank you, Jay. We're excited to celebrate our first anniversary of our IPO last week. Over the course of the last year, we believe that our partnerships with Cyrus and Stifel, our proprietary origination and dedication to sound underwriting and focus on secured investments, have helped us to build a resilient portfolio. We have grown from $173 million invested at the time of the IPO to over $316 million as of year-end. I'm very proud of our team and all they have accomplished as we've worked together over the last year. Turning to our fiscal quarter ending December 31, we believe that the leveraged finance markets saw a broad repricing of risk driven largely by the collapse in oil prices and the resulting effect on secondary prices for loans and bonds to companies associated with the oil and gas sector. Of course, E&P companies, oil field services, and even those simply located in important oil-producing regions have all begun to see the pressure on their revenue and earnings. Larger syndicated capital structures traded down sharply, and as we noted in our press release on January 15th, we were not unaffected by this dynamic. In the less liquid middle market, oil and gas producers and service companies have seen the same fundamental pressure driven by the decline in oil prices. Despite the 50% decline in WTI since the summer of 2014, we believe we have underwritten loans well-positioned and well-capitalized. Our focus has been on security, our attachment points, our borrower's hedging profile, and asset coverage for our loans. Our investments in the sector were among our most conservatively structured deals in the portfolio. We are also diversified geographically. Our exposure to oil and gas, both E&P producers and servicers, is spread across most of the major producing basins with essentially no overlap. The oil and gas sector has been a major focus for us, as I'm sure it has been for all of you. In September, our investments in exploration and production, midstream, and oil field services represented 25% of our portfolio at fair value. As of December 31st, that percentage was 20.5%. A portion of that reduction resulted from a change in our marks. A portion is attributable to our new investments away from the sector. And finally, there was an element of timing associated with the reduction of our investment in AAR, an oil field services company, which I discussed on our last quarterly call. As you may recall, our loan to AAR funded on September 30th, and we brought in a partner in early October. This took our hold down to our target size of $20 million. I'd also like to note that AAR has scheduled amortization representing 15% of the original principal during the first year. So you will see that position size reduce as of 12/31 and in the coming quarters by virtue of the scheduled amortization. In 2014, we made 29 investments, including 15 new portfolio companies. Six of those investments were in the past quarter, including two new portfolio companies. In our January 15th press release, we provided detail on these new investments, and I'll recap for those of you who may have missed that release. In October, we made a $15 million second lien to Bird Electric. Bird is a Texas-based company that provides utility services to both oil and gas and regulated utility industries. Bird services the electrical grid, performing maintenance and repair, as well as doing work to electrify new projects in the Permian Basin. Bird also performs storm repair work throughout the southern United States, which on the side kept them very busy during January. In December, we made a $20 million first lien loan to ASV in conjunction with a partner. This investment was sourced through our partnership with Stifel. The total size of the loan is $40 million. ASV manufactures skid steer and compact track loaders, which are used in the construction and building industries. Our loan backed the formation of a joint venture between Terex and Manitex, who now each own approximately 50% of ASV. We had 25 companies in the portfolio as of December 31st, with a total fair value of $316 million. And as of today's call, we have investments in 26 companies. Our new portfolio company investment occurred in January. Through our partnership with Cyrus, we had the opportunity to participate in a new DIP loan for LightSquared. We think that the asset coverage is outstanding, and the recent spectrum auctions validate the asset value. As of today, we have sold a portion of our LightSquared position and have funded exposure of $4.6 million of a $10 million total commitment, which is our target hold size. Since our last quarterly call, we have three new loans, Bird, ASV, and LightSquared. And we also had two investment realizations. In December, our investment in CT Technologies, also known as HealthPort, was repaid with a prepayment premium. HealthPort was sold to a new equity investor, and all of its outstanding debt was repaid. Our unlevered realized IRR on this position was 12.8%. Secondly, in November, we sold our investment in Icaria, realizing an IRR of 11.4%. This was the smallest position in our portfolio. We realized the gain, and its current yield was substantially below our targets. So we considered this to have been successful and opportunistic sale. Finally, an important event was our investment in Virgin America. Our original investment in Virgin was sourced through our partnership with Cyrus and was made in 2013. As of September 30th, we held approximately $5.9 million of first lien and $5.9 million of second lien and a small position in warrants. We converted these three positions into cash as well as shares in Virgin as of the IPO. Our basis in the shares is $20.91 per share, a discount to the IPO price, which was $23. We provided additional detail about our Virgin stock position in an 8K filing on January 15th of this year, and I encourage all of you to read that release. We had a realized gain of approximately $600,000 and have an unrealized gain on the equity position of approximately $10.6 million as of December 31st. Virgin and ASV are two great examples of our differentiated sourcing channels through our long-term relationships with both Cyrus and Stifel. Our pipeline remains robust. On our last two quarterly calls, I mentioned a deal that we expected to close in the fall. That particular investment was for an oil field service company operating in the Bakken. We have decided not to make this loan. Away from that deal, we have a number of deals in the pipeline, all senior secured, all expected to yield 10 to 13%. Over the past several quarters, our focus has been on quality direct origination to allow us to invest in loans to middle market companies and continue to rotate the portfolio out of some of the syndicated and lower yielding transactions. During the quarter, our mix of first and second lien investments remained balanced. At fair value, we held 46% first lien, 46% second lien, with the remainder in warrant and equity positions. The big change from the previous quarter is obviously our position in Virgin's equity, which represents approximately 7% of our portfolio. Our target for portfolio leverage is 0.6 to 0.7 times. At September 30th, we were 0.58 times levered. As of December 31st, we were 0.66 times levered. We're comfortable here at these levels. Going forward, we expect to continue to replace some of our lower-yielding syndicated investments with more attractive loans as deals in the pipeline develop into investable opportunities. Our portfolio grew from $299 million as of September 30th to $316 million as of December 31st. The weighted average yield on our debt and income-producing securities at cost declined from 11.72% as of September 30th to 10.97%. This is a consequence of the repayment and conversion of our loan to Virgin and the timing of our close on the loan to AAR around September 30th. Our new portfolio company investments this quarter, ASV and Bird, yield in line with and above our target yield of 11%. Going forward, we will continue to focus on opportunities to improve the average yield on the portfolio in a prudent, disciplined way through well-structured and secured investments. We are also monitoring several opportunities in the secondary where we think there may be attractive entry points into existing loans well below their new issue prices. Our team has a long, deep background in stressed and distressed investing, and we think that finding opportunities in dislocated markets has the potential to differentiate us from our peers. During the quarter, we earned our full base and incentive management fee. Going forward, based upon the current portfolio, we expect to continue to fully earn our base management fee and to earn a portion of our incentive fee. Additionally, we continue to work with our outside counsel, Sutherland, on our application for the SBIC license. Finally, on January 28th, our board of directors declared a first quarter dividend of 34.69 cents per share payable on April 2nd to shareholders of record as of March 18th. With that, I'd like to turn the call back to Jay to review our results for the second fiscal quarter of the year.
Thanks, Mike. Our net investment income for the quarter was $4.6 million, or 34 cents per share, and aggregate net realized and unrealized gains were $3.5 million, or 25 cents per share. The weighted average yield at cost on our debt portfolio was 10.97%. Our debt portfolio was comprised of 91% floating rate and 9% fixed rate investments. Our average portfolio company investment was approximately $11 million, and our largest portfolio company debt investment was $20 million. Additional information regarding the composition of our portfolio is included in our Form 10-Q filed yesterday. With respect to our financing facility, we had $39.4 million borrowed under our $50 million facility at quarter end. As of today, we have $10 million available under this facility, $20 million in cash, and $12 million in expected proceeds from the partial sale of the LightSquared investment Mike mentioned earlier. Lastly, I wanted to address our accounting policy on fee income. Unlike some BDCs that book origination fees as fee income upfront, we accrete these fees as interest income over the life of the loan. Our fee income consists of loan amendment and consent fees received during the period. In the December quarter, we recognize $114,000 in such fees. And with that, I'll turn the call back over to Mike.
Thanks, Jay. As I indicated, our quarterly dividend will be 34.69 cents per share. We made a commitment to our shareholders to increase and grow our dividend, and we will waive a portion of our incentive fee to do so. This dividend level represents a 9.25% yield on the initial IPO price of $15. That's an increase from 9% dividend yield in 2014. Over the course of the past year, in addition to growing the portfolio from $173 million at the time of the IPO, we've also improved our average yield by 25 basis points by transitioning the portfolio toward attractive middle market, directly sourced investment opportunities. We have no loans on non-accrual. Our portfolio has no exposure to mezzanine or unsecured debt today. Our underwriting is focused on security and covenants for the protection and preservation of shareholder capital. We think that our portfolio is resilient, carefully structured, and positioned to provide excellent returns for our investors. Operator, with that, I'd like to open the line for Q&A.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. If you would like to state a question, please press star 1 on your phone now, and you will be placed into the queue in the order received. You can press pound at any time to remove yourself from the queue. Please listen for your name to be announced, and be prepared to ask your question when prompted. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. Our first question comes from Robert Dodd from Raymond James. Please state your question.
Hi, guys. Congratulations on the quarter. Just on kind of the, obviously, the portfolio detail you've given us before, so we appreciate that and the color. On the market, you say the, obviously, there's been, just if you could just expand on your comments, particularly as they align to your expertise, which you discussed. I mean, your track record in some of the distress and stress, and obviously your relationship with Cyrus. Are you seeing, you know, on the pipeline side, is that starting to fill up with more of those opportunities, or is it still a little too early, maybe in the credit cycle, for that to be pushing, filling up that available bucket? And just kind of tying into that on the pricing front, you said that the backlog's kind of 11 to 13. If in future, how much extra yield, tough question, would you demand for participating in kind of a like-for-like distress or formerly distressed credit versus a performing, previously performing loan?
Good. Thank you, Robert. There's a couple pieces to that question.
Yeah.
So let me try and attack them. And number one, talking about kind of our background, there's the team that we've got here of individuals away from the Stifel Banking Network that sources deals and away from Cyrus. That team has some roots in distressed, but specifically to your point, Cyrus is a firm that's been around over 15 years. It is and has a long history of opportunistically looking at senior secured debt as a way of investing in dislocated, stressed, distressed opportunities. And I have worked on and off with Cyrus myself since 2002, directly, you know, with Cyrus, working on this venture for now 3.5 years, you know, it'll be 4 years in September, directly, but I've worked with them for literally 13 years. So there's a lot of expertise. We have, ongoing dialogue across our sourcing channels, whether or not it's Cyrus, Stifel, or the individuals directly here at the firm. So that's the expertise. Now a couple of things as far as the pipeline and what we're seeing. We're seeing a few things coming forward. I would say that given our portfolio concentration right now within oil and gas, whether or not it's E&P or oil field services, I would doubt that we'd do anything unless we saw some movement down from what we've got today as far as reinvesting or putting more into a stressed situation. Even if we thought it was attractive, we think we have well-structured, right attachment points, well-secured issuers who have hedges on or who have customers who have long-term hedges on. So that sector I'm going to just address because I think it's important to address that. Away from that sector, we are seeing some opportunities. I think it's on the early side. We are seeing some opportunities come in. Right now, I would say they have not hit our quality bogey, and we're talking to Cyrus about a couple. That is the kind of the low price. The other side of it is, you know, in Lightsquare, the great example, are dips or rescues, and on the dip front, our math is that you're covered at least six times, probably 6 to 10 times covered by asset value on that dip loan. I mean, from a value and a risk perspective, it is a great loan at a 9%+ return to us. That is something that I would say no one would have access to unless you've got a relationship and a partner like Cyrus who has been active investing in it throughout its life. And they will invest in things because they have a different profile earlier than we would. And so the dip is one example of real opportunity that has already hit, and that hit over the last couple of weeks. From a excess return, there's obviously that dip falls into a lower than our average return, but with a 6 to 10 times coverage from an asset perspective, it's lower risk than return, and it is highly, highly liquid if we ever wanted to transform that into another opportunity. But from a stress situation where there are lower dollar points, and I referenced that when I spoke earlier, I think that, you know, and everything changes based upon the markets and the opportunities, but a low teens would be the low side of our entry point from a return, and the mid to high teens would be the sweet spot if we were looking to do something like that. And that is what we look for when we evaluate those type of situations. We haven't seen one that we want to go into yet, but we continue to look at a lot of opportunities.
I hope that. Yeah, very helpful. Thank you. Oh, just one kind of additional follow-on. How would you characterize, obviously, you know, if we look back in mid-14, right, the credit markets broadly were frothy with the level of competition driving loan prices. So, but how would you characterize the level of competition in the distressed kind of markets in terms of how cyclical can pricing and attachment points get in that market relative to, obviously at a different scale, but relative to how frothy the broader credit markets got at their peaks?
I actually think it got very frothy, especially from a distress standpoint, because what we didn't see was a lot of cracks out there. We didn't see a lot of new distressed opportunities. And so a lot of the distressed players were all competing for similar deals. Now, one of the ways, we have two ways to differentiate ourselves on that platform. Number one is, you know, to the extent there are opportunities that are $50 to $100 million opportunities and we want to team up, we can, with Cyrus or somebody else, we can look at those to do it on a very small club. The larger distressed players really need, you know, multi-hundred million dollar positions to make it worthwhile for them to dip into. So, you know, someone who runs a $5 to $10 billion distress fund really doesn't want to have many 1% positions, and that's a $50 to $100 million position, a 1% position. So we have the advantage of, even as we grow, a $20 million position is a full position for us. So 10 to 20 makes a lot of sense, and there's going to be opportunities out there from time to time. That's not going to be our core business, but it is going to be things that at the fringes differentiate and help our risk-return profile, because typically when we look at these, they have already been through some type of restructuring, some type of stress, distress. We're not going in early. We're going in later at excess returns. You know, and if you look at over time our investment in YRC, that's a great example. That had gone through, you know, 6-12 months of restructuring before we ever entered it. We've been invested in two iterations around YRC pre-IPO and post-IPO, and has been a very secure outsized return if you look at it over its life.
Okay. Thank you. Very helpful. Thanks a lot.
Our next question comes from Andrew Curie from BBC Income Fund. Please state your question.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon, Mike and Jay. Thank you for taking my questions.
Hey, Andrew. How are you?
Good. Good. Yourself?
Good.
Good. So just wanted to start maybe on AAR and U.S. Well Services as well. I know with AAR you had discussed in the past, and this is consistent with the other BDC you sold off a piece of this investment to, you know, very low leverage attachment point if you look at obviously the trailing 12 months months EBITDA. But now just, I guess, kind of looking forward, I mean, obviously, you know, these contracts, I believe, are set to be repriced, if I'm not mistaken, sometime this year in both U.S. Wealth and AAR as well. You know, kind of, has there been anything post maybe 12/31 that you can discuss that would indicate maybe some, you know, some way that you would want to look at those credits differently, either from a CapEx from the underlying customer standpoint or the contract repricing that would make you think there would be a risk to the fair value in either one of those cases?
Yeah, listen, it's something that's been front of mind for us for several months now, and I know front of mind for all of you on the phone. These credits, meaning energy credits across the spectrum. And so I think I've said it in the past, but I'll bore some people and repeat it. With our energy credits, they are things that we look at constantly. We have a constant dialogue and constant, I will define as, in some cases they are weekly, some bimonthly, usually over a period of 2 to 6 weeks at most. Reaching out and having discussions with the management team or equity owners at these credits. And so the two that you mentioned are, you know, fall squarely in those dialogues as well as everything else does. What we have seen, and it's probably a good opportunity to expand the question, just talk about what we've seen across the energy sector, because I think we sit in a very interesting place across probably half a dozen different basins of the United States between our E&P exposure and our oil field services, and just to talk about what we're seeing. We're seeing consistent themes, and they're not going to be any surprise to everyone on the phone who's done a lot of work around the sector. The E&P producers, most have hedges that are out at least 6 months of 2015, some as far out as 4 or 5 years from now. In there, you see all of them, irrelevant of their hedges, going back to all of their suppliers and whether or not they are material suppliers, labor, on any front. And you've seen it in, I think, public releases from people like Halliburton, et cetera, asking for cost reductions in these environments. And we've seen our E&P producers go back and ask for those cost reductions. And that's why when you look at what is the cost to extract oil in a specific area, the number keeps moving on what it is and keeps moving down because costs keep moving down. And then if you take this to the next level, we've got investments with U.S. Well and others who have had those requests, who are responding and moving forward. At the same time, they have their own suppliers and they have a lot of labor. I would say that 100% of the companies that we've spent time with, and we've spent time with basically everyone, have gone through and instituted cost-cutting internally. And I'm going to round here because I don't want to go into name-by-name detail. It'd probably be inappropriate. But the rounding is squarely the center point of where everyone is operating. Around 10% cost reductions from, I'll call it, the CEO down to secretaries at service companies. They've gone back to their suppliers, and they're pushing for cost reductions. So the reductions that you're seeing at the E&P that they're asking for are ending up around that same 10%, and you're seeing that filtered through all the way down to the individual worker. Now, the workers had been a beneficiary over the last 2 years specifically of escalating salaries and bonuses and overtime. So overtime's cut back and the base rates have been cut back. So you're seeing all that filter through The interesting point that I think we're seeing is from an E&P side that, you know, we are continuing to see production. There's, you know, multiple wells or long live reserve, one of the two, at each one of our E&Ps, so that production continues, which is part of what continues to cause the problem of inventories, et cetera, when you look at the weekly numbers that come out. But that production continues. You may see some tail off, but not significant over the next 6, 12 months from our clients. We also tried to make sure we were with top-tier operators, whether or not that was the Banu in the, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, Kalis, who has Apollo as a sponsor and committed to it as a sector, and New Standard, which would be a smaller operator, but one of the largest equity investors there is Magnum Hunter, who is active in the operations at that E&P. As well as, if you go down and look at the oil field services, where we've got key clients, which include Anteros and Noble and Pioneer and others, and they're top tier. Those are the, it's the smaller operators that are starting to either cease operations, sell to others, but the interesting point that I was trying to lead toward is that our service providers are seeing basic stability around the request, and in a couple instances, they're actually seeing an up tier in volume but pressure on their price. And it's a very awkward situation where you see an up tier in volume because they are viewed as one of the larger, more stable operators providing services, and where others they're fading away from because they're smaller and less reliable in this market, our clients have picked up some business. So that actually creates a weird dynamic, especially with the labor side when you're asking to take cuts and you're not pulling back, but it actually has been successful so far.
Thank you, Mike. That's great color. So I guess maybe just expand on that a little bit. You know, so there's, I mean, obviously the entire sector, right, from a pricing standpoint, has gotten pretty much across the board hit pretty hard. I mean, have you been seeing any opportunities where, you know, there's the idea that the lower cost, right, service providers, the ones that are better positioned as CapEx budgets get cut. Have you been seeing any interesting opportunities? And I think you had alluded to a little bit of this before, where you would, maybe not quite yet, but you're starting to maybe look at some things from a due diligence standpoint that might look interesting in terms of lower cost oil field services companies that may be able to actually gain market share in this environment as the E&P companies look for lower cost providers, given, you know, should oil kind of stay where it is.
Well, there's two things, and one, I just want to backtrack for 1 second because part of your question, I'm not sure if I answered, and I want to make sure I answered, which is when we went into these and we talked about all the pressure and everything, we had done our models assuming a couple things. Number one, we started out at a base that was probably in the March to June, July standpoint. So we were running more off in a last year 2013 analysis, which most of these guys grew in 14, and we were haircutting that 13 from a level standpoint. So our attachment points from an EBITDA were anywhere from, you know, flat at worst, I'd say today from a run rate, maybe down 5 to 10%. But most of them had EBITDA that was coming in 20, 30% above where we had underwritten. So it's falling back down to where it is today is consistent with base cases or downside cases, and even has room from our downside case to fall further, and we would expect that some will compress a little bit further down and still be well within our underwriting case that we did. One of the questions that I don't remember who asked it, and I think people will laugh when I quote this, on the last earnings call was, how do you get something so attractive as AAR at the returns and leverage point? Well, the answer is it's oil field services, and, you know, people are nervous about it, and being able to look at someone who's doing $100 million of revenue and knowing that they should be one of the consolidators and going out and visiting in person with their clients and sit with Noble's chief person in the basin and doing that diligence is part of what got us there. But also turning around and saying that we don't look at this thing as a 2.5 times levered. We look at it as probably a 3.5 or 4 times. If it runs at 2.5 times, that's great. We schedule in upfront structuring of real amortization, 15% in the first year and everything else. So those opportunities are there. I don't think that from our perspective there'd be anything, especially we are very, very conscious of portfolio composition and we're happy with where it is, but saying that there are some opportunities that we go into if we're not reducing first, I don't think there's anything there that we would. Are we starting to see some names that look very interesting if we had zero energy exposure today? The answer is yes. Absolutely yes. And, you know, but I think that's, you know, a purely academic question.
Sure. No, certainly appreciate that. No, that makes a lot of sense. And then the last question I had was on the liquidity side. So, certainly appreciate the color on churning some of your lower yielding book and the SBIC process, albeit, you know, as you're well aware, Mike, the SBIC process can take some time. But given, you know, you're at, you know, roughly the upper end of your target leverage, how do you think about, you know, weighing the need to, you know, to obviously have dry powder to fund new originations, you know, while not having a lot of you know, call it excess capacity aside from basically the portfolio churn at this point, weighing that kind of against essentially the need for external financing?
Well, you listen, it's a great question. We're very focused on being prudently levered at all times and, you know, preserving capital for everyone. Dry powder, we kind of think about it as $40 to $50 million of cash today. And that's $10 million available in this facility, $20 million of cash on the balance sheet, and there's $12 million of proceeds coming back as we normalize our light squared investment. That similar to AAR, we closed on a larger amount. There's another guy coming in. So between those three components, that's $52 million. I think of that. $42 million. So I think of that as $40 million plus or minus. In addition, we have, and I spoke to it in generalities, earlier on we did some investments that are more syndicated and more liquid at lower yielding, specifically things like Crestwood YRC, there's $20 million there. There's New Wave, Ennis Flint, TNS, Regional Care. There's several that are probably another $30 million. We like the credit profile of all those companies. The ongoing return, if we find good 11, 12, 13%, we've got the ability to cycle out because it's a broad group of investments. We don't have to sell 10 or 20 million. We can sell 2 or 3 million of a few names and have a very nice new investment and be able to manage our yield, our exposure, and portfolio diversification importantly.
Great. No, that's certainly helpful. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it as always.
Thank you, Andrew.
Our next question comes from Merrill Rawls from Wunderlich Securities. Please state your question.
Good afternoon. I had a couple of questions. I'll first ask about the valuation of the warrants on PRY, which looks pretty volatile. Update there?
Yeah, thank you, Merrill. It's one that probably frustrates me a lot in that I don't know that the market is giving value to the warrants the way we have. And so we are very, very strict about adhering to, you know, the valuation policy of looking if there are public activity and then validating around that public activity. So there is a broker-dealer that actively, makes a market in this. And so the mark you're seeing is there. We do think that, number one, they continue to perform fine. So everyone knows what it is. This is Open Mobile Puerto Rican Telecom. The issue around it really at the time of the investment was the underlying value of the asset and over time would we realize on a session in warrants, and I believe it was 22.5% of the company the lenders got in the form of warrants, and that's why you saw an initial large amount ascribed to the warrants. And as a lot of people will appreciate, we think about we've got debt there and we've got warrants. And we think about the warrants usually as
equity upside option that we do not pay for, but accountants and SEC ask us to ascribe value to and take it out of the debt. The company has continued to perform, and from a thesis standpoint, if any of you are, analysts that actively cover the wireless sector, you'll be well aware of the government auction that just concluded over the last couple of weeks in the spectrum, and it was just a record levels put on the value of spectrum across the country. That included the auction of in Puerto Rico of similar spectrum. Two blocks went, so there's a very good comp. There were four bidders on it. And when extrapolating, I'll give you our numbers, extrapolating and doing work with some of the bankers who followed it, puts a value on the spectrum of $240 to $260 million. The debt on PR Wireless is $180 million. Our mark, it reflects really the activity, and I'm only guessing here, but I'm guessing, I think, with some level of history and accuracy on my experience, that you had some sales here that were really unrelated to the credit, but some people who had portfolio reasons for wanting to sell. And so there was pressure on it from that standpoint. I'm speculating. But from a fundamental performance of the company and a validation of the underlying asset, we think this thing has a lot of upside to not only to where it's marked, but to where our cost was.
Great. I can understand how that's frustrating. Can I also ask, when you sold or monetized the $12 million from the portion of LightSquared financing that you sold, was that at the same price you paid for it or an improved price or, just want to know if there's an there.
As you will see in most when we do things like AAR, they are basically at cost. We're working with partners and club members. So that was not an attempt to try and get an increased price. That was basically a cost.
Okay, that helps. And my final question for right now, what are your plans regarding the monetization of your Virgin Airlines stock, regardless basically of the price? I mean, obviously you probably wouldn't sell it at a loss right away, but I just wanted to know how long you'd hold that position. If the price is volatile or if it's not?
Well, thank you for the question. I really thought that might be the first question we got today, and I'm surprised it's so long. As I think everyone is aware, we have a six-month lockup that we agreed to as part of the IPO. So May 13th is the day that lockup will expire. We, monitor that the same as we do all of our investments. It is one that once the lockup rolls off, I think we will have extensive discussions about it. Our intent is not to be a long-term equity BDC, so we will look to find an appropriate time to monetize it. Just to put it in perspective, because I know it was one of the questions from our board as we reviewed everything with them, as far as overhang and other selling shareholders, when our lockup expires, we are the only ones with a six-month lockup. Others have a year lockup, and we are the only ones really independent that I'm aware of from the Cirrus Aviation Group, which is a investment vehicle they put together, and the Virgin Group. Others are locked up within those agreements. So I don't think that we've got a lot of other overhang between 6 months and a year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Meryl.
Our next question comes from Troy Ward from KBW. Please state your question.
Great, thank you, and good afternoon, gentlemen.
Troy.
Just a couple quick questions regarding, portfolio composition. The first one is a quick follow-up to the end of the conversation you were having with Robert Dodd. You were talking about the distressed market and the deep experience that your broad team, including Cyrus, has in that special lending category. Just put that discussion into context a little bit as far as your portfolio goes. What percentage of your portfolio, would you say has some level of that distressed investing in its history, and how much do you think the CM portfolio will have in the future in that, you know, kind of specialty category?
The few that I just highlight off the top of my head, and I want to just make sure I give you an accurate, so I'm looking at the list, but we had MF Global that ran off last summer. We have YRC that came through that type of dynamic. We have the new Light Squared that came through that dynamic. And then Banu came through that dynamic also, which was came out of the AGT, and they were the good assets that came out and were invested. So I think those are the principal ones that came through. And then as far as what's the maximum amount, listen, if you said to us out of that type of scenario, we're probably, give or take, one or two names where we'd want to be in that type of investing. But if we rolled back the calendar 6 years and said we're in 08 going into 09 and we've got an opportunity to be looking at a lot of the loans that were trading at 65 to 75 cents in the first, second, third quarters of 09, that percentage would be very different.
Okay, great. That's a good color. Thanks. And then one final kind of portfolio composition question. You know, when we did the energy analysis, then all of the analysts did across the space on the BDC space. You know, CMFN came up with the most exposure to energy across the sector. Now, we realize, obviously, as a smaller BDC, you know, you're going to have less diversification until you reach maturity and things like that. But, you know, the 20% plus exposure, can you just talk about, you know, was that a conscious decision on your team to overweight the group? And if so, you know, what did you see there that was so compelling? And how do you view it, quite honestly, at what percentage of your portfolio, once you are a larger portfolio, do you intend to stay at that level?
Listen, it's a great question. And yes, we did it consciously. And as we did it, we actively managed it. And let me just take you through some history and some numbers. The percentage was higher than 25%, and it was significantly weighted toward E&P. As we continued, you know, after the IPO and looked for places where we understand the risk, we understand the hedging, we understand the attachment point, we felt that that is a place that you continue to get paid for the risk you are taking. In addition, I think very importantly from a portfolio perspective, and I know I mentioned this on our last call when we did the update post December 31st, we think about, are there natural hedges in our portfolio? And there was no doubt that as we shifted our portfolio, Virgin was a natural hedge. We had a well-secured position. We had options on Virgin, and we were active with Cyrus around IPO and timing with the bankers. From shifting the portfolio, we actively sold ATP before the IPO back in 2013 to make room to grow more of the energy. As we came in to 2014, you saw us manage at the edges $4 or $5 million of both Kalis and Banu. And as we came into August, we sold down totally our Endeavor exposure. And that was shifting out of the E&P as we balanced between that and services, where we've been able to have attachment points and total leverage of, well, attachment points of zero and total leverage of 2 to 3.5 times, depending on the credit. And, you know, we've been, I'd say, very diligent, very conscious of capital preservation, you know, being the number one thing, and making sure that we think there's an appropriate return. Focusing on outsized returns can be something that I think comes back to bite you. I think focusing on the right structure and amortization and things like that is what we've tried to focus on. So that's a bit of a historical perspective. Going to your question prospectively, I would say that over time, in a normalized environment, listen, if I could
wave a magic wand, I'd say let's take our exposure to zero. You guys would all be happy. And then I could talk about opportunistically investing 5 to 10% of the portfolio in great investments. But in a normalized environment, I think that 10% plus or minus is probably the right area, 15 probably on the high end and 5 on the low end. Because energy, you know, if you can find the right risk return from a portfolio and a diversification, is an important component of the overall GDP, geographically, industry, everything, and I think a good diversified investment in our portfolio. There will be times where we think the market becomes too bullish on it, and we're just going to fade away. As you notice, we were not bullish on sub-debt and other levels of the energy sector, and that was by design. And, you know, the high-yield market was on fire. I think the number was 16-18% of all issue last year was in energy. And that, in that structure, we were not buyers. Hopefully I answered the question.
You did. Thanks, Gus.
Our next question comes from Allison Taylor from Oppenheimer. Please state your question.
Hi. Good afternoon, guys. My questions have been asked and answered. I really appreciate the call.
Well, thank you, Allison, and thank you for calling in and being on the call.
Thanks very much.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. At this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, everyone, and one last time I'd like to thank our team here for everything they've done day-to-day, monitoring, originating, and everything else, and thank all of you from the analyst side.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for attending.